the Sangha is invited to go back to our breathing, so that our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, going as a river with no more separation. Let the whole Sangha breathe as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of a delusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
Good morning, everyone, and this is our second day of our seven-day 2011 retreat on the Vimalakirti Sutra. You might have noticed that Vimalakirti, due to your good practice and aspiration, has shown up here. So, you know, there are some people who say, you know, a lot of the Mahayana sutras, were not really spoken by the Buddha, and a lot of these things are made up by, others who came after the Buddha. So you can say, no, Vimalakirti really did exist. I saw a somewhat exact a replica of him. So it's good to have Vimalakirti on the altar, where we can offer him the respect and the praise he is due. There was one question, comment for me, and I thought I'd use that just to talk about grasping. Seems to be a favorite topic around here. Oh, by the way, Carol, I have a suggestion. For a specific special mudra for Southern Dharma. Mudras are these gestures that Buddhas make. They transmit profound teachings just by a gesture. So I'd like to suggest a mudra for Southern Dharma. Would you like to see it? You know, it can replace bowing when people greet each other. I couldn't resist. Forget. So there was a question or a comment or something that said the letting go thoughts. One, tell a newborn baby not to grasp. It's built in! Exclamation point. Two, the veteran who must carry a knife or gun in pocket once told the story that he had finally replaced the gun with a chapstick. Maybe one day he can let the chapstick go, just an empty pocket. Three, quote, I am attached to eating. If I stop, I will die. That's how it feels to let go. Four, blah, 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 etc. Okay, I get it. Sort of. But more commentary would be welcome. So I thought this was a very, very good. The first one, you know, tell a newborn baby not to grasp. It's built in. It's sort of that part of us that goes, no, grasping is built in, right? It's the way all of us, you know, no, you know what I mean? The self is, I'm hardwired to have a self, or, you know, my personality is set, or my issues are so deep-seated, you know what I mean? We don't. And then number two I thought was good, because it's sort of like, the bargaining gradualist approach. All right, I can change, but, you know, it takes time and slowly, and we start out with guns and knives, and we end up with chapsticks. And maybe, you know, when we're fully enlightened, we can let the chapstick go. Right, so that's good. And then it's sort of, I'm attached to eating. If I stop, I will die. Again, I think that's very profound. But I think people actually believe that, don't you? Don't they? We are so identified with the things that we grasp at, especially our self identity, the things that the self reifies and reinforces itself with. It's almost as if we let go of it all, it'll be all over. And many people do really feel it. Believe that. And often that is an experience of people when they do begin to disentangle themselves from the illusion of self, especially in terms of a meditative experience, and begin to unhinge from all their constructs in which they've created their world, self-created world. They get very scared. Because it seems as if they won't exist anymore, or something terrible will happen if they really let go and enter the world of nothing, the world of emptiness, the world of shunyata. In a certain way, it is true. Actually, we do have to die. But again, dying in the sense that I mean it is in the sense we will all one day die. But really what we're saying is that the body will die. We might be surprised that we are not necessarily the body. And so it is true that one day we will have to let go of this body, and we will realize at that moment how we've built our total identification of who and what we are with the body. But then we will experience leaving it. And yet, here we are. So in a sense, we do have to die. You know, I forget who said it. You know, what's that saying? He or she who dies before they die does not die when they die. It's like that. So we have to die, which here just means let go. Stop identifying with the self, the I, the me, the mine. And, what came to mind, it's sort of like trading up. You know, you may think, oh my God, I trade in myself, what am I left with? Oh, you may be surprised that you're trading up. You get something much nicer. Works much better. So let's just talk about for a moment grasping. Again, it's a pith teaching. Coming back to our opening lines of Vimalakirti, which we have talked about in past retreats and we mentioned in this one, they have learned to accept the fact that there is nothing to be grasped at, no view of phenomena to be entertained. So in Buddhism, grasping is not hardwired. And I'm not going to go into it today, but if you, and I advise you or encourage you to study the 12 links of dependent origination, which is one of the basic formulations within Buddhist psychology, Abhidhamma, it is clearly structured and set out the steps what causes one to grasp at phenomena. And if you trace it back, the grasping comes from ignorance. Right? That very early on in the development of this mind of ours, we begin to objectify reality, phenomena, as something outside ourselves. When we make that fundamental split, it's called entering the world of dualism, of duality, right? Me and you, inside and outside. Right? When we make that fundamental movement into duality, perceiving things as outside of ourselves and also then compounding it with seeing things as solid and real and self-existent and permanent and you know, et cetera, et cetera. Because of that fundamental split, which causes us to feel empty, not in the emptiness sense, but in like something missing sense. We've left our true home. We've left our true interconnection and oneness and interbeing with everything. And so therefore, in this split, and in this beginning belief that I am a separate thing, separate from everything, I begin to look around, or the self begins to look around, for things to make it believe it's real. Right. But again, it's not real. It doesn't exist. So it has to constantly work at creating the sense that it's something. And so it sees stuff. And it hears stuff. And it thinks stuff. Right? And it feels stuff. All these things are just arising. But self begins to what? Grasp it. Put things together. Create, it's like Legos. Begins to create bigger constructs. And it thinks that's the only way for it to feel alive, for it to feel meaning, for it to be happy. I gotta get them. I got to get things, I got to get people, I got to get relationships, I have to get love, I have to get respect, I have to get self-esteem, I have to get, I have to feel good. Because the self doesn't feel good by itself. So it endlessly is grasping. Right? And, some people are grasp at this, some people grasp at that. Some people are mild graspers, some people are really tight-fisted graspers. You know, they're all different type of graspers in this world. Content of the grasping and the way people go about it. But it's all fundamentally the same. but at its source is this lonely, scared, alienated, disconnected self. That is why in this practice that has to be directly looked into. And when it is seen into, and when we reverse the process, either the process is always, we have always gone out, further and further out. We're always looking around. But when we stop looking around, and we turn inward, and we follow the steps back, to come back to our true home, to return to our true connection. That's what we do in this tradition. That's what the real practice is about. And the practice of calming and the practice of mindfulness and all these other practices we do to quiet things down and clarify things are also then we can look into. So we can return home, right? Like Hansel and Gretel, right? We follow the breadcrumbs back home. Hasn't been a good time living with the witch, right? We're always being fattened up for something. And you know where it's going to end. That witch has plans for us. And that's the way it is with all our grasping, all our clinging, all our, you know, all that stuff. All our manipulating, all our protecting, all our advancing. It all ends up in the witch's oven. Just the heat may be different at different times. We want to leave the witch's house. We want to return home. So that's why in this practice we turn inward. We stop turning out. You know, it's interesting. There are probably many of us who still, even when we come to retreat, we're always looking around the meditation room, we're looking around in the dining room. You know, one of the things when you begin formal training is you learn to regulate the body. You know, and in the same way we learn to regulate the body in our meditation posture. You know, we take a certain posture. But also we learn to regulate the body in terms of, you know, how we enter the meditation hall, how we bow, how we walk mindfully to our cushion. But traditionally, you're also taught to keep your eyes down. Again, just because it's a sign that when you're in the practice setting, your view is inward. Right? So you're not attending to the comings and goings of who's coming in, who's coming in, where the whoopee that sounds, you know. You know, what everybody else at my table is eating, and you know, all that kind of stuff. We're not attending to that. Our eyes are regulated. We are attending because we are practicing mindfulness of eating. We're not practicing mindfulness of our neighbor's plates. Are we? No. We're not practicing mindfulness of who's coming in now into the meditation hall. That's not our practice. They had learned to accept the fact that there is nothing to be grasped at, no view of phenomena to be entertained. So again, as we said yesterday, let me just say it again, the direct path, the pith teaching is let go. Stop grasping. Right? When you see yourself grasping, stop it. When you see yourself holding on, let go. That's the direct teaching. No nonsense there. Right? Now, as Alex pointed out, we may not be there yet. We may not be there yet. And we'll find out we're not there yet, because when we do it, either we don't want to do it, like we know we should do it, but we're not ready to do it. A lot of us, we're still pretty perverse, and we still cling to our bad habits, even though we know they get us in trouble. Even though we know where they lead us, we still in the moment cling to them, hold on to our self-righteousness, et cetera, et cetera. So we may not be there yet. Right? We may not be ready for the direct path. So in their wisdom, the Buddhas and the Masters have developed many, many Dharma doors for us. Right? And so the Dharma door I talked about yesterday was the Dharma door of the four seals, that those of us who've been in the intensive dealing with investigating the mind know about. Which means when we are encountering phenomena, and phenomena means everything. Everything is a phenomena. There's physical phenomena, there's mental phenomena, all kinds of phenomena. A thing, dharma, small d. Dharmas are means phenomena. So when we encounter phenomena, we are interested to investigate the nature of phenomena. And again, without going into it, upon investigation, we will see that all phenomena shares the same characteristics or same marks or have the same seal, which is, even though they appear to be permanent, upon investigation, we see they are impermanent. Subject to change. Even though they appear to be solid upon investigation, we see they're just made up of composite parts that have come together because of causes and conditions, and when causes and conditions change, those parts will change. Three, that as opposed to phenomena being sources of happiness, when we are grasping at them or when we are perceiving them, we often see that actually phenomena, because of the nature of grasping, are actually in many ways sources of suffering and not sources of happiness and well-being to us. And fourthly, that all phenomena is marked with the seal of non-self, even though it may appear that we are in a world of selves, including this one. Upon investigation, we will see that what appears to be a self actually does not exist. For example, I may have a thing about flowers. So I perceive a flower, and I immediately go, I want that flower. Okay, I want to have that flower. Because in my deludedness, I think if I have that flower, somehow what? I'll be happier, or my life will be better, or some crazy reason, right? So I then no longer just perceive it, right? I now want it. All right. Now, if I bring in the awareness of the four seals for a moment, I might notice what? First of all, that this thing called a flower is not really a thing called a flower. There's no such thing as a flower. It is just parts. And if I took all the parts, if I took the petals, the leaves, the stem, and etc., and put it out, I would find there's really no such thing as a flower that's solid in any way. All right? It just has a temporary reality that it's manifesting the way it does. And because of that, it is subject to what? Impermanence. Then actually, if I took it home with me, wanting it, loving it, always thinking that it's a source of happiness, within a few days, what? I'll begin to get a little disturbed. Because I will notice what? My flower is no longer as beautiful and wonderful the way it was when I got it. Right? And I might even, you know, so I may get sad, I may get hurt, I may get disappointed, I may get angry. Damn it. You know, shouldn't happen this way, shouldn't happen to me. How come flowers don't say the, you know, same? I mean, right? So I could get angry. I could get frightened. Oh my God, what am I going to do? Life without a flower. Life without my flower. I'd be like, what's that little guy up there in the little prince with his flower, carrying his flower around wherever he went. You know, so again, I could have a full-blown emotional crisis. But if I have stopped and I've been willing to see the composite, non-self, impermanent nature, I understand what this is. And I don't need to grasp at it. I don't need to hold on to it. I can still appreciate it in the moment. I could still enjoy it in the moment. But I, you know. And I also know, as I just said a moment ago, that I understand that if I grasp it or cling to it or in any kind of way, this thing which I think will be a source of happiness to me is going to be a source of suffering to me. So why do it to myself? So in this way, like through these practices, of practicing the, you know, direct investigation of the four seals of phenomena, it also helps me what? Not grasp. Takes a little more time, right? The direct path is boom. But many of us, most of us, aren't there, so we need these kinds of practices. You know, in the Indian tradition. Because, you know, one of the big things human beings grasp at and identify themselves with, of course, is their bodies. I am my body, you know, name and form. So we see ourselves as bodies. And so we know there are meditations where we take the body apart and we lay it out and we see, you know, we peel off the skin and we lay out the skin and we lay out all the parts and we lay out all the organs and all the ligaments and all the muscles and, you know, and we just lay it all out. Hard to be attracted. Hard to be attached when we see it that way. But that is the way it is, right? I mean, it's all that sewn up. Right? When it's sewn up, we're very attached to it. But when it's all spread out there, we go, oh, I don't want that. I'm not that. Not Fred. He's not just a bunch of parts. Right? So these kinds of meditations, which reveal the true truth about reality, need to be practiced over and over again. Right. So then the non-grasping becomes easier. Okay. Practices like we did this morning. Five remembrances. That's an antidote to grasping. Because what are we grasping at? We're grasping at healthy body. We're grasping at youthful body. We're grasping at body that doesn't die. We're grasping at loving relationships and people that will always be there in my life, right? So everybody here is grasping at that stuff. Right? And yet the five remembrances remind us, you know, not of a horrible, morbid interpretation of human life. It reminds us just of the facts, right? Just the facts. Reality. The nature of bodies. their true aspect, right? They age, they get sick, they die. And that is true for us and true for everyone. That's just the truth. When we understand that, it doesn't mean that we, give up bathing. It doesn't mean we give up washing our clothes, or, it doesn't mean we give up taking care of our, you know what I'm saying? It's not all that. But we go about it with understanding. So, I could go on and on, but what you see is most of the practices that are, or many of the practices, are helping us, making it easier for us not to grasp. Because, again, we're grasping at things that are ungraspable. Because they're not solid. They're not real in any self-existent sense. And things cannot give us happiness of any kind. The only happiness we get from them is the happiness we get when we get them. Then we're happy. But when they start slipping away or changing or we get bored, then they're not a source of happiness to us. We've got to go find something else to make us happy. They have learned. So maybe there are people here who've learned to accept the fact that there is nothing to be grasped at. So see whether in 7 days each of you can accept the fact that there's nothing to be grasped at. Please understand, he's not saying the philosophical point of view. He's not saying the Buddhist view that there's nothing to be grasped at. He's going much more beyond that, isn't he? He's saying the fact. It's a fact. So again, over these 7 days, please do your own investigation into the nature of all phenomena that you encounter. External phenomena, internal phenomena, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and especially that phenomena of me, my, I, self. And you discover for yourself whether any of this is solid, real, permanent, self-existent in any way. Right? If it's a fact, it should be readily apparent to everybody, right? If it's not a fact, if it's just a Buddhist view, or then we should have lots of different interpretations, shouldn't we? So it's like that. So please use these days to... once things have quieted down, you're here, and the emotional stuff that was kind of rising up yesterday is maybe quieter. We're kind of settling in, letting go more here. Please investigate the nature of your mind, the nature of your experience, the nature of phenomena. So you can learn to accept the fact that there's nothing to be grasped at. Right? That's the better way of doing it. Like you get it. I think a lot of people struggle because they do it from the outside. Like letting go is good for me. But when you understand deeply that what you're letting go of, one, is not graspable in its true sense at all either. And when you understand that all grasping leads to suffering, then letting go is not that hard, is it? It's coming from the inside. It's coming from understanding, wisdom. Is that clear? Good. So at the end of 7 days, we will we'll go around the room and we'll hear from everybody whether you've accepted the fact that there's nothing to be grasped at. Do a little self-evaluation. So, we are in Chapter 6 of the Vimalakirti Sutra, Beyond Comprehension. And the last thing spoken by Vimalakirti to Shariputra was, "Therefore, Shariputra, if one would be a seeker of the Dharma, one must not seek it in anything at all." And as we said yesterday, when he had spoken those words, 500 heavenly sons and daughters gain the purity of the Dharma eye in their perception of phenomena. Now, hang on to your seats. We're about to go on a ride. At that time, the rich man Vimalakirti said to Manjusri, "You have visited countless thousands, tens of thousands, billions of aksamkayas of countries." Aksamkaya. It's an ancient Indian numerical unit indicating an uncountably large number. "You have visited thousands, tens of thousands, billions of asamkayas of countries. What Buddha lands have the finest and most beautiful lion seats, those endowed with the best qualities?" Sort of a home decorating kind of question. Manjusri replied, "Layman, to the east, beyond countries numerous as the sands." I mean, do you see how grand this is? Right. I mean, just go with it. It takes us out of our ordinary. Right. Thousands, tens of thousands, billions of amsakayas. "Layman, to the east, beyond countries numerous as the sands." Usually it says the sands of the Ganges is a very typical expression for, like, you know, beyond countable. "This is beyond countries numerous as the sands of 36 Ganges." Now please remember, as we listen to this, we are all quite impressed with the profound nature of what's being taught here, right? The same people are writing this. "Lies a world called Sumeru shape." Sumeru in Indian cosmology, their cosmology is in the middle of all these universes is Mount Sumeru, and then there are these continents, four continents around Mount Sumeru. But there are lots of these kind of places. There's a world called Sumeru shape. It has its own Buddha. All world systems have its own Buddha. We had Shakyamuni. In the world of Sumeru shape, their king is called Sumeru Lamp King. And he's there now. Now, this Buddha's body, this is Sumeru Lamp King, is 84,000 yojanas in height. And I did look up yojana. Yojana is said in ancient India was the amount of distance that an Indian army would travel in a day.
Oh,
So this Buddha's body is 84,000 that distance in height. And the lion's seat he sits on is 84,000 yojanas high and adorned in the finest fashion. Quite beautiful. The rich man Vimlakirti then exercised his transcendental powers, and once that Buddha dispatched 32,000 lion seats, tall, broad, adorned, and pure, and had them brought into Vimlakirti's room. Remember Vimlakirti's little room? Remember? I mean, if you thought that Shariputra was freaked out before, you know, like, where's everybody going to sit? Now, like, you know, where are these gigantic lion thrones all, you know? Okay, so not only do we have these, all right. So dispatched 32,000 lion seats, tall, broad, adorned, and pure, and had them brought into Vimlakirti's room, where the Bodhisattvas, major disciples, Indras, Brahmas, four heavenly kings, and all the others saw something they had never seen before. For the room was broad and spacious enough to hold all the 32,000 lion seats without the slightest crowding or hindrance. The city of Vaishali and Jambudvipa, which is the whole continent, and the other of the continents, too, seemed in no way cramped or inconvenienced, but all appeared just as usual. It's interesting. We look at things and we see things bound by space and time. We see things solid, permanent, self-existent. And so therefore, we don't see a lot of flexibility in ourselves, in life. Right. Within our own minds, we often feel our minds are very full already. Right? No room for anything new. We are so fixed that the way we are and the way we think and our views and our beliefs about ourselves and everything else, like, are taking up all that space. Right? This is a different way of looking at things. In a little bedroom, 32,000 lion thrones, lion seats, each one 84,000 yojanas high, all fit. They're trying to show us something here. At that time, Vimlakirti said to Manjusri, "Sit down on one of the lion seats. The Bodhisattvas and all the other distinguished persons should also sit down. And when they do so, they should assume bodies suitable to the size of the seat." So you see, Chris Vimlakirti had something up his sleeve with seats for everybody. So then the Bodhisattvas, who had acquired transcendental powers, thereupon immediately transformed their shapes, making themselves 42 yojanas tall, and sat down on the lion seats. How wonderful. How adaptable. They weren't fixated on anything. They could change. Right. Space and time, most of us, we are bound by space and time. Right? We are enslaved, imprisoned by space and time. For Bodhisattvas, enlightened beings, it's just something to play with. There's nothing solid there. endlessly playful. So the ones who had acquired transcendental powers immediately transformed their shapes, and they became 42,000 yojanas tall, and they sat down in their lion seats. But among the bodhisattvas who had newly embarked on their course, this is their course of practice, bodhisattva, or the major disciples, there were none who could climb up theirs on their seats. They hadn't gained that freedom to adapt, to become whatever they wanted to be, according to causes and conditions. They were fixed, right? So they couldn't do it. At that time, Vimalakirti said to Shariputra, poor Shariputra, "Shariputra, you sit down in a lion's seat." But Shariputra said, "Layman, these seats are too tall and wide. I can't climb up on them." This is very interesting. Again, I don't know how other people comment that. I'm sure they do it differently. So this is, you know, first of the fully awakened ones, right? And they have no trouble. You want me to be 42 yojanas high? I become 42, you know. According to causes and conditions, endlessly able to shift and shape, not bound by reality at all. But then there are the, you know, lower level practitioners, still bound by name and form. You know, and you can kind of see them trying to stretch. Just can't get up there. Like us, right? Many people get discouraged. They come to retreat, they can't sit like fully awakened Buddhas. Right? They don't have perfect concentration. Their minds are still creating stories. They're still grasping at things, right? Still having trouble adjusting, you know, right? We're like these guys. We can't just easily and gracefully just take the seat that's offered to us. Right? Please understand that if they were offered just a regular seat, they would have taken that. Right? But they were offered these lion thrones, so they took that. They didn't discriminate. So this is interesting. But Shariputra said, "Layman, these seats are too tall and wide. I can't climb up on them." Vimalakirti then said, "Ah, Shariputra, if you will make obeisance to the thus come one, the Buddha, Sumeru Lamp King, remember he's the Buddha of that universe, then you'll be able to take a seat." Interesting. So the bodhisattvas who had newly embarked on their course and the major disciples accordingly made obeisance to the thus come one Sumeru Lamp King, and after that they were able to seat themselves in the lion seats. You know, what's going on here? I think this is kind of interesting, you know. And I think, again, I think this is very meaningful. It shows us there is hope for us. There is a way for us, okay? We may not be a fully enlightened bodhisattva, right? Totally free and liberated, and therefore able to move in all realities without any impediments, totally able to adapt freely and wisely and compassionately to all situations, right? So Sariputra is speaking for all of us, right? When he says, you know, I'm not there yet. I'm not there yet. So does that mean what? I can't join the assemblage, right? And Vimalakirti says again, interesting. What does he say? He says, make obeisance to the Buddha, Sumeru Lamp King, and then you can take your seat. And they did, and they made the abasement. So what do you think that means? What's going on here? He asks as he blows his nose. Is this going to be recorded? You've heard of the lion's roar of the Dharma. Well, I think it's an interesting, again, this is my, you know, I don't know what other people would comment. I know that there are, I don't think any of them have been translated. I mean, again, as I said, this is a very popular sutra in China, Japan, Korea. Many commentaries were made on them. I tried to do a Google search, and I couldn't find any translated at all. And maybe they will come in time. So, you know, what you got to understand is within Buddhism, we have all these great sutras and teachings, but also lots of commentaries over the years by great masters, which are very wonderful, you know, the commentaries. But in this stage of the transmission of Buddha Dharma to the West, you know, most of what is being done is just kind of the original texts are being translated. You know, hopefully in time more of the commentaries, so we can get the wisdom of the ages in terms of understanding them. So I think what he's showing us is there is that other path, which is the path of devotion, which is the path of surrender. And I say this because I think this is harder for us as Westerners to really grasp is not the right word, grasping in the sense of understanding. I'm using it in that meaning of grasp, to understand. In other words, when, even though you know that as much as we can tell from teachings that are purported to be of the Buddha, that it was a very, you know, rational, tested through your own experience, practical path. We know over time, as Buddhism developed, it also, you know, became a little, had more trappings of religiosity and that whole aspect of devotion and surrender. Because, you know, it is possible if I don't know the way, and somebody else does, and I trust them. Even though I don't know the way, or I might not even understand why I'm even going that way. But I trust somebody who tells me, this is the way, and it will take you where you want to go. And I think that's what's going on here. Saying to Shariputra, yeah, you are not fully realized. But in making obeisance to the Buddha means you're surrendering to his infinite wisdom and knowledge. It's almost, that slogan you see on, what would Jesus do? It's sort of like that, which I think has a lot of wisdom behind it, because if we are not fully grounded in our own inherent wisdom, so we are clear how to act in a wise and compassionate and skillful way, then what do I rely on? Well, for most people, they rely on their own self, which, as many of us know, is not always that reliable, not always a good friend. Not always gives us the best advice, right? Because what do we know about that self? It is created from the past. So it basically is always advising us based on how it's been. And so there is that ground, that transition ground between, you know, in Buddhism, in terms of so-called, you know, the Buddha Sangha, there is the ordinary ordinations of laymen, laywomen, monks and nuns, bhikshus and bhikshunis, upasakas, upasikas, the fourfold Sangha, you know. But then there's the Arya Sangha, and the Arya Sangha is composed of beings from any of those four classes that have had insight, and that goes from stream enterers up to you know, fully enlightened Buddhists, right? And their classifications of the Arya Sangha, the higher community. And it's considered that the stream enterers have had enough insight that they have entered the stream of the Buddhas, and therefore they will be carried along by that stream. There is a knowing now. So they no longer have to rely, you know, on externals. They have entered the stream of their own self nature. And therefore, that will now carry them along deeper and deeper into the fastness, mountain fastness of the true Dharma. But prior to that, it doesn't flow like that. It's back and forth. It's up and down. It's in and out. It's encouraged. It's discouraged. Right? We haven't entered the stream yet. Well, what Sariputra is saying, and I think it's very profound, my friends. He's saying, if one has not entered the stream of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the stream of Dharma, because one has not awakened yet, then you can enter the stream of the Buddha Dharma through faith and devotion. Or we could say trust. You know, I trust the Dharma. I trust the teachings. I trust the teacher. So even if it's not my own experience, or even if my own mind is not telling me so, I let that go, right? Because I know there's something more reliable to trust. So this is very important, and I think this is why, you know, it is always a profound interest to see, to encounter so many people in Asia or other places who know very little about Buddhism in any formal way. I mean, they're Buddhists, but they know very little about formal Buddhism or teaching or sutras or whatever, and yet live it. Because what you often find in those people is they have deep faith, right? Deep trust. And, you know, because the lama, because the monk, because whatever, told them that this is the way to do it, or this is the way to see it, or this is the way to act, they just do it. Right? They don't, they don't challenge it, they don't, you know, give it their own spin, you know. I'm probably exaggerating. I'm sure there are many who do. But it's interesting. So again, I think what Vimalakirti is saying in this very simple thing of, because it's quite profound, it's saying, you know, you can get up there too. And all you need to do is bow to the Buddha. Now, obviously, it's not just bowing to the Buddha, right? Right. I mean, you could train a gorilla to bow to the Buddha, but I don't think the gorilla would get it. It would just be an action, right, that it was trained to do, because it got its banana. So there has to be that heartfelt trust and acceptance. And one can get a lot of mileage out of that. You know, that is why hearing teachings, studying teachings, reflecting on teachings is considered, from the Buddha's own advice, so important. So the teachings get inside us. We hear them. In days of old, people would memorize, and that's why a lot of the teachings, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, there's a wisdom to numerics, right? Because it's easy to remember. Oh, three marks of existence, right? Four seals, right? Oh, you kind of pull it out. So, again, this is something maybe over the course of these days you reflect on. Do I really trust? I would imagine most of you in here have taken refuge. Right. I know many of you have taken refuge with me. I would imagine others have taken refuge other places. Maybe some haven't. That's fine. But this is what refuge really means. To take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I place my trust in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I don't place my trust in my historical self. Though somebody might go, well, that's very disempowering, right? Or somebody else might say, I've been working for 20 years to develop a trust in myself, and now you're telling me not to trust yourself. Well, it's a little different. It's not like that at all. It's at a deeper level. It's understanding. For those of you who want to really enter the stream of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, like what do we say in the incense offering? May I be companion. May I be companions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. What does that mean? It means just this. It means I see the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, I see Vimalakirti as my companion. Right? What a wonderful companion to have in this life. Right? I mean, many of us have lots of nice companions, good friends, but they're not like Vimalakirti. Right? They're not going to bring us to full enlightenment. It might be fun to have a beer with or something. They may be funny. Right? You know what I'm saying? Or they might be good companions or good friends, or, all kinds of good support, but they're not going to lead us out of suffering. They're not going to lead us into clear wisdom. Right? So that is why in the incense offering we say, may I be companions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It means like when we do our prostration in the morning, to the Bodhisattvas, we take them to be our companions. We walk in this life with Samantabhadra, great Bodhisattva of action, with Avalokiteshvara, great Bodhisattva of compassion, right? Like that. They're not just abstract, I don't know what, but they're real in a very meaningful way. They are our companions. They're the ones we look to when we are choosing a path of action in this life. Anyhow, I think so I'm saying in that little again, I think it's very important, that he says, I realize you can't do it on your own. Right? Make yourself big enough to fit on the lion throne. But go bow. Go make obeisance to the Buddha. And they did. And all of a sudden, there they were. Proudly sitting on their lion throne with all the big shots. All the big people. See, Shariputra just must have been ecstatic. Actually, let's see what he says. So they're all seated, and Shariputra says to Vimalakirti, "Layman, I've never seen such a thing. A little room like this, and still it can hold seats as tall and broad as these. And the city of Vaishali is in no way crowded or obstructed, nor any of the towns or villages of Jambudvipa, or any of the other four continents cramped or inconvenienced, or the palaces of the heavenly beings, dragon kings, and spirits." And now Vimalakirti says, "Ah, Shariputra, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have an emancipation that is called beyond comprehension." This is very key. Now Vimalakirti is introducing his Dharma. He's talked about it in the past, but now he's giving it a title. This is Vimalakirti's Dharma. This is his way of emancipation. It is called beyond comprehension. When a bodhisattva dwells in this emancipation, she or he can take something as tall and broad as Mount Sumeru and put it inside a mustard seed without enlarging one or shrinking the other. And Mount Sumeru, king of mountains, will still have its original shape. Moreover, the four heavenly kings and gods of the Triastrimsha, heaven, that's on Mount Sumeru, that's where they live, will not even know or realize where they've gone. Only those destined for enlightenment will be able to see that Sumeru has been put inside a mustard seed. This is called dwelling in the doctrine of the emancipation beyond comprehension. Remember Blake, to see the world in a grain of sand. The whole Mount Sumeru in a mustard seed. Or again, this bodhisattva can take the waters of the four great oceans and pour them into the opening that holds a single hair, without the fish, turtles, sea turtles, lizards, or any of the sea creatures being in any way troubled. And these great seas will still have their original form. And the dragon spirits, as sure as the others who live in the sea, will not know or realize where they have gone to, and these beings will not at all be troubled. And it goes on and on. I mean, this is just so beautiful. Or again, Shariputra, the bodhisattva who dwells in this emancipation beyond comprehension can slice off the 1,000,000,000-fold world, grasp it in the palm of his right hand like a potter's wheel, and toss it beyond lands as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, and beings in the world would not know or realize where they've gotten to. The bodhisattva can then bring it back, put it in its original place, and none of the people will have any idea they've gone somewhere and come back, and the world will have the same shape as before. Again, Sariputra, suppose there are beings who want to live in this world for a long time, but are qualified to enter enlightenment. The bodhisattva can stretch 7 days into a kalpa. That's a long period of time. So that to those beings, they really seem like it's been a whole kalpa. Or those beings who do not want to live in this world for long and are qualified to enter enlightenment, this bodhisattva can squeeze a kalpa into 7 days so that these beings think it seems like only 7 days. Again, Sariputra, the bodhisattva who dwells in this emancipation beyond comprehension can take the magnificent adornments from all the Buddha lands, gather them together, and show them to the living beings in a single country. Right? Can place all the beings of a single Buddha land in the palm of his right hand and fly them around the 10 directions, showing them everything, and yet them moving from his original spot. I mean, does science fiction have anything on this? Right? Already seeing beings flying around, traveling from world to world. Oh, Shariputra. This bodhisattva can take all the objects offered to the Buddhas by beings in the world in the 10 directions and make them visible within a pore that holds a single hair. Or take all the suns, moons, stars, and constellations that belong in the worlds in 10 directions and make them visible within the pore of a single hair. Can go down into the lower regions, past Buddha lands, numerous as the sands of the Ganges. Pick up one Buddha land, lift it to an upper region, above Buddha lands, numerous as the sands of the Ganges, as one would lift the leaf of a jujube tree on the point of a needle. And that land will be no way troubled. What are these guys up to? What are they up to? To see the world in the grain of sand? Or how about hi diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle? The cow jumped over the moon. How could that be? Children don't ask, do they? Right? The dish ran away with the spoon. It makes total sense to a child, doesn't it? What's happened to us? That we go, no. No, 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 no. Cows don't jump over moons. Cows do jump over the moon. When we have freed our minds of the boundaries of space and time and logic, which is all in the realm of thought, right? When this emancipation is called incomprehensible, it means what? That the thinking mind can't understand it. If we stay in our thinking mind, we can't understand it. If we stay in our thinking mind, we can't even imagine that we could be Buddhas. We can't imagine it. We can't imagine, remember Shariputra, the Buddha is describing the pure lands, and Shariputra says, what are you talking about? You know, I see just a, it looks pretty gross to me. I mean, you know. Like that. Where ordinary beings see imperfections, the enlightened vision sees perfection, with a capital P. Not a perfection that stands opposed to imperfection, but a perfection where everything is as whole and complete and perfect just as it is. But that kind of understanding is beyond comprehension. That's why this is said, this is the practice that goes beyond comprehension. Beyond thought. Beyond, as member Jim McCurdy said yesterday, this Dharma is not about idle theorizing. It's hard for us to comprehend that each and every one of us have the seed of Buddhahood within us. That each and every one of us have never left home. Never. Have never been separated from our true nature for even an instant. We can't comprehend that, can we? To comprehend that, we have to let go. What do we have to let go of? Everything. everything we've built up, all our thoughts, all our projections, all our interpretation, all our constructs of the way we view the world, so we can see what's right in front of us. Right? If you in the morning we recite the verses on the faith mind, right? It's right here. It's right here. Right in front of us. Could that be? So this is why we practice mindfulness. This is why we practice concentration. This is why we practice insight. So we can empty the mind of all its notions, all its ideas. The Heart Sutra is helping us do that. Verses on the faith mind, profound teaching, helping us to do that. Birds helping us to do it. Trees helping us to do it. Creeks helping us to do it. Anyhow, forgive me for muddying the waters.
Question, but I have a point of clarification. Your audience is vast, and this is a recording that gets memorialized because it goes out on the internet. And at the beginning of your talk, you talked about this gesture that was going to be emblematic of Southern Dharma and Carol, and that might not come out on the tape so well, and it leaves a lot to the imagination. Do you want to clarify that before we end the recording?
No, I think I'd rather leave it to the imagination.